This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
A few years ago, I had severe back trouble, bad enough that I could hardly walk. I would sit on the sidelines at recess and watch as these young people were twisting and turning and thinking, wow, you guys have no idea how grateful you should be for your flexibility. And I thought, the back trouble went on long enough that I thought I was probably destined to suffer from it for the rest of my life. You know how it goes, like you get used to whatever situation you're in and you feel like that's always what's going to be. So I was going to the chiropractor and not really getting that much help. So with little background that I had in, I was planning to go to college, or I went to college for pre-med, was planning to go to med school, so I've had an interest in medicine ever since then. And so I have a little bit of background there. I've done a lot of work at learning how to research things online, so I went to Dr. Google to figure out what my problem was. And eventually decided that what I needed to do was to go to a physical therapist to deal with the slipped disc that I had. I had diagnosed myself with such. But I knew that to go to a physical therapist, you need to have a referral. So I went to my family doctor and I said, I've got this bad back. I need to get a referral to a physical therapist. The doctor took one look at me and said, no, you don't. He said, I'll have you fixed in 15 minutes. And he proceeded to show me that what was actually going on was that my hamstrings were too tight and it was pulling my hip crooked, I guess you would say, and that was giving me the back trouble. So he showed me that what I need to do is loosen my hamstrings and I'll be fine. And sure enough, well, in 15 minutes he showed me the various stretches I needed to do. It took 3 months of hard work to actually get there. But I haven't had back trouble since. So, I had background knowledge, I had motivation to learn what I needed to learn, and I came to a very wrong conclusion about myself. Thankfully, I hadn't figured out how to do surgery on myself or something. We get our students asking us this question in multiple different ways, but why do I need to memorize facts when I can look up facts on the internet? No problem. We have Wikipedia, we have, well, Google just in general. We have facts available to us all the time. And as Anthony pointed out in the session just before this, we carry them with us. Most of us carry our smartphones with us, and thus have facts available to us everywhere we go. So why do we need education? As I've been doing, I'm planning today to talk about what is going on behind the scenes, what is the question behind the question, or the assumption behind the question. But I'm going to do a little bit of an aside and attack the question directly for a little bit before we get into intellectual character. So, what's going on behind the scenes? What is the student possibly thinking when asking, why do I need to memorize facts? Well, I would say two are really closely related to each other. The first is that education is about information. I had a student who was planning to drop out of school and go to do online school who told me, oh yeah, I'm going to do online school. I'll still be educated. Education is about facts. Education is about information. And information, this is the second thing, information is about facts. These are two things that students assume when they think that they don't need to learn the things we're trying to teach because of the availability of Google. So I'm going to give a direct answer to that based on cognitive science, and I was really grateful that Anthony did his session before me here so he could draw the little brain diagram there. So we think about thinking. Thinking is a transitive verb. You have to think about something. You can't just think, right? And we recognize that what we want our students to do is to think. So, they need background knowledge. Now, I'm just going to refer to this model a little bit as our way of learning information. New information comes in. Now, right now, you are being bombarded by information from all around you. Hopefully, there's one stream of information that you're really focused on, but you have other streams of information that you're ignoring right now. You're ignoring the feel of the seat below you. You're ignoring the feel of the shoes in your feet. You're hopefully ignoring the hunger pangs in your stomach right now. You're ignoring many, many stimuli that are coming into your brain. And this is pre-processing. This is stuff that's going on really without your conscious mind recognizing it. It's getting filtered out. So when you're looking at something, when you're listening to something, you recognize when you're, if you're in a crowd, you hear all these noises. When you hear your name, you perk up. Why? Because your filter system lets that through, okay? So there's only a very small amount of the information that's coming into your senses actually gets to your brain. Okay? Another illustration of this is when I'm driving, right after I've bought a new vehicle, I notice how many other people have a vehicle exactly like mine. I bought a Ford Escort. Everybody has a Ford Escort, it seems. Like, I'm seeing Ford Escorts all the time. I didn't notice them before. I worked on a gutter crew for 2 weeks, and at the end of the 2 weeks, I was driving along and just noticing all the houses that needed new gutters. Right? We notice things. Our filters change over time, but everything gets filtered. Before it ever gets to your brain, it gets filtered. But when it gets into your brain, it gets into your short-term memory, or your, you can call it the sketch pad, but that working memory, that short-term memory, that's where information that makes it through your filtering system, the pre-filtering, your sensory information, it gets processed there in that short-term memory. You could almost think of that as like RAM on a computer. Now, most of that gets forgotten pretty quickly. You can only hold a little bit of information at any one time in your short-term memory. If you rehearse it, you can maintain it. So, for example, I look up a phone number, and I need to go over to somewhere else, and I just say this number over and over to myself while I'm getting my phone so that I can quickly type it in and call the person I'm trying to call. But I rehearse it. That keeps it in the short-term memory longer, but I can only keep it there for so long before it decays and disappears. Okay? Now, when you're learning something new, it comes into your short-term memory, and then it also, what you also do is you pull from your long-term memory into your short-term memory, and you put the two together, and your long-term memory can change over time as long as what's in your short-term memory connects to what's in your long-term memory. Okay? So, this is an example of where the rich get richer in learning. The more you know, the more can get through to learn more. I use Mr. Russell, as an example, those of you who don't know him are missing out. He's an instructor here. Steve Russell is an instructor here at Faith Builders. And he is his mind is like a steel trap for new information. He reads something about history once and he's got it. He's got dates, he's got this vast store of information. But why? Because he knows so much, he has lots of hooks to put new information onto. So the more we know, the faster we can learn. That's the cognitive science. We can assimilate new information better when we already know more. Now, it actually turns out that the pre-filtering process also works better the more we know. When I learn a new word and I'm reading along, I I'm reading something completely unrelated, and I see this new word. It pops out to me, and if I didn't know that word, sometimes it just gets filtered out, and I miss a key piece of information from the thing I'm reading, but that's because it got filtered out. It was unfamiliar to me, and I just, it slips past, okay? So why do students need to know facts and information? They need to have it readily available in their brain, because otherwise they have no way of even knowing what to look up or how to process the thing that they are looking up. There was a news story a number of years ago that said doctors routinely Google symptoms that they're seeing in patients. And everybody thought, oh no, that means my doctor is no better than I am. He's Googling things, I'm Googling things, what's the difference? Well, the doctor can recognize what's important in this information and what's not. If I had truly had expertise about my body, then I would have recognized that these symptoms I'm seeing are not actually a slipped disc. With a little more background information, my Googling would have been more effective. So, cognitive science tells us that the more you know, the more you can learn, and also the more you know, the better you can process new information. So, education, there is information required in the education process, and information does include a lot of facts, but that's not the only thing about education. And we'll get to that in just a second. The third thing that students may be saying when they're trying not to learn something based on the fact that they can Google things is that they're making this assumption that they can readily discern between facts and fiction when they read something online. And I will hasten to say that I obviously can. I always know when I'm reading fake news and when I'm reading something true. Or not. You will recognize that it is, as the amount of information that's available to us gets bigger and bigger, it becomes harder and harder for us to process and to figure out what's true and what isn't true, or even more importantly, what's important and what's not important. The sources of information that I was consulting for my back trouble were all well-respected sources. I was looking at Mayo Clinic, I was looking at WebMD, I was looking at places that have well-researched information. They were reliable sources, but I didn't know what was important and what wasn't. So, what's the intellectual character trait that we need to develop in our students if they are going through life thinking that they can always tell the difference between what's true and what's false? I'm going to contend that that character trait is humility. I'll start by saying that humility is not, in the words of C.S. Lewis, pretty women trying to think they're ugly and clever men trying to think they're fools. It is not denying the good things about ourselves. Intellectual humility is not falsely declaring ourselves to be nothing. If that were the case, then Chesterton would be right when he says that kind of humility would produce a race of men too mentally modest to believe in the multiplication table. So that's not what I'm talking about when I say intellectual humility. It is not just denying the things we have to offer. Rather, intellectual humility is a recognizing our dependence on God, and it's also treating others better than ourselves. So Philippians 2 is an example of humility. We trot this one out all the time, I know, but it fits, so we use it. So Philippians 2, he says, if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only on his own interests, but also on the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So humility, treating others better than ourselves, recognizing that the thing I have does not give me a special place. I don't have a special position because of what I have to offer. Authentic humility is an attempt to see ourselves as we really are. And notice I say an attempt to see ourselves as we really are. We don't see ourselves very well. That's why we absolutely need to develop friendships in our lives with people who will tell us the truth. Faithful are the wounds of a friend because we don't see ourselves well. We need to understand that we are made in God's image. As such, we have the ability to seek truth and to find truth. But we also need to recognize that we're fallen. And as such, we are not perfect in our pursuit of truth. We have false motives. We have poor processing sometimes. All kinds of things go on in our pursuit of truth. We mess up. Humility recognizes that. So then we also need to understand that as a group, we are dependent on God to show truth to us. So authentic humility is an attempt to understand ourselves or to see ourselves as we really are. Humility also values truth over ego. It values others sometimes over ego. For this, I want to turn to 1 Corinthians 8. Paul here is talking about divisions in the church. And he uses an example that at that time connected. I'm going to change it a little bit to use an example that connects with us. Now concerning COVID, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. Concerning whatever the subject is at hand, we all possess knowledge, quote unquote. So, how do we recognize when we're lacking humility? What are some features of a lack of humility? I'm thinking specifically in school. One, there are many. I'm going to give three. The first is competition. When I am happy about my score because my score is better than all my friends, that's a lack of humility. When I, as a teacher, am not happy because the other teacher is so popular, that's a lack of humility. when part of my happiness or sadness comes from a difference in outcome between myself and somebody else, it's a lack of humility. So competition. That is not, of course, to say that all competition comes from a lack of humility. Witness the upbuilding kind of competition where everybody's cheering for each other but hoping that they themselves do just a little bit better. But if you can't cheer for the opposition, if you can't appreciate that the other side made a really good play in softball, we've got a lack of humility going on. So competition shows a lack of humility. Second, that I see is unwarranted certainty. Czesław Miłosz, in The Captive Mind, quotes an old Jew as having said this: when someone is honestly 55% right, that's very good, and there's no use wrangling. And if someone is 60% right, it's wonderful, it's great luck, and let him thank God. But what's to be said about 75% right? Wise people say this is suspicious. Well, what about 100% right? Whoever says he's 100% right is a fanatic, a thug, and the worst kind of rascal. If I am so completely sure that I'm right, that I cannot conceive of a world in which I might be wrong, I've got a problem with a lack of humility. Unless, of course, you are right. Or not. We can hold our being right with an open hand. My dad is full of these kinds of aphorisms. He used to say, "You're so right, you're wrong." He was saying that to me because I needed it. I had a reputation that I held fairly proudly, actually, of always being right. I always chose the position I did because I was sure I could defend it. If I picked a side, it was one I had carefully chosen that because I knew I could defend it and I knew I was right. I lost a lot of friendships over that. The third. Is an ability to discredit experts on the basis of my own research. Or maybe actually another way of saying the same thing is that is an inability to see how anyone could be so dumb as to believe whatever the thing is. How can anyone be so dumb as to believe? If I, with my even 2 hours, even 10 hours of research, can discredit what people who have spent their lives studying, if I can do that, then I'm probably not completely understanding their point of view. And I'm going to use here an illustration that where I know they're wrong. I actually do know they're wrong. Okay. There's there are a number of world religions that believe in reincarnation. When you die, you come back as something else. And if you were good, you go up the ladder. If you were bad, you go down the ladder. So the cow might be grandma, right? That is, like, in my mind, I cannot even understand that point of view. How can you possibly believe that to be true? Okay, so I know it's wrong because it's not biblical, right? It goes against Scripture directly. However, if I carry my rightness with an attitude that says, "You are so dumb for believing this," guess how many people I'm actually going to convert from that belief system? Exactly zero. If I don't take the time to actually understand where they're coming from, I'm not going to be inviting to them. So, again, there are many, many others. I chose three: competition, unwarranted certainty, and an ability to discredit experts on the basis of my short research. These are all lack of humility in me, and also markers of lack of humility in my students. So then, why would I want to develop humility? What are the benefits? Again, there are many. I've chosen three. The first is a growth of knowledge and insight. If I can rejoice when I'm proven wrong because I got to learn something, that's a benefit of a lack of humility. You know how often it's been that we say something and somebody says, no, you're wrong, and we go back and forth, and at the end we're both mad and neither of us has changed our point of view, and somebody missed out on an opportunity because one of the two was wrong, don't know which one at this point, but that person missed an opportunity to put their mental model, make their mental model better, more like the world actually is. Now, we can all just in general recognize that we're wrong about something. Like, I know I'm wrong about something. I don't know what it is. Okay? So when you and I disagree about something, here's an opportunity for me to recognize maybe one of the places that I'm wrong. I might not be wrong here, but if we can talk about it, not in terms of a conflict, not in the case where one of us is vanquished and the other one is victorious, but rather that the two of us together are trying to figure out which one of us is wrong so that person can benefit by now being right. Think about how different our interactions would be around all of the things that we fight about. Our world be richer and larger. This is the second thing. Our world is richer and larger than if we are intellectually proud. We've heard the stories of the tourists who go to a foreign country and stay in a Western hotel, eat only at Western restaurants. They go on a sightseeing tour and they see things, but they never enter in. They take pictures and they post them on their social media accounts, and it's all great. But guess what they're missing? They're missing the actual experience of being there. When we go into a non-Western culture and bring our Western answers to all of their problems, guess what? We're missing an opportunity because of our intellectual pride. Third benefit, our influence is increased if we're humble. I already mentioned the case of evangelism, but I'll tell a personal story for this one. I told you that I grew up, or when I was younger, I had the reputation of always being right and defending my point of view as long as it took till the other person gave up. In 2007, I got a job offer to teach in Colorado. It was a tiny community. I knew one person in the community, but I decided I would do it. And before I left, I heard some bad things about this community. I heard there are a bunch of legalists there, and I was young and vigorous, and I said, okay, well, the way you change a legalistic community is you change their children. And so I'm going to go in and I'm going to change this community by changing their children. You can all, you have enough experience to know how well this went. So I got there and I started teaching school. And one of the school board members was also a minister. He was my age. I was 23, I think, at the time. So he was young and he really felt the responsibility of his task, of his role there as minister and as school board member. And so I had this community pegged as a group of legalists, right? So one day, this young minister got up and he gave a sermon, and I was listening to this sermon and I thought he said that you can't worship God unless you're wearing the right clothes. You can't worship God properly unless you're wearing the right clothes. So I took exception to this. Right? I was wearing the right clothes, but I knew that you can worship God in whatever clothes you're wearing at the time. And so after church, I walked up to him and we started arguing. And wouldn't you know, this is actually kind of embarrassing. It's really embarrassing for both of us. We stood there and we argued in the parking lot until at least 1:30, I think it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, while his wife and children sat in the van. I ran into somebody who was every bit as stubborn as I was. And he was my boss. Back and forth, we argued. Okay. That summer, I went back home to Ohio and I worked for my dad. I was driving a truck, hauling farm machinery. And I was driving, had hours and hours to think. And at some point, somebody said to me, you know, you can either be right or you can be happy. And it clicked. I don't have to argue with this guy. Kept processing, went back with a different attitude. I started seeing the community for who they were. These were people who actually love God. They were doing the best they could. They had people from all over the eastern United States who had problems with their churches that moved out there. How do you forge a community from 100 different places? It was smaller than that, but you know what I mean. How do you forge such a community? It's hard. And I recognized what they were doing. And that second year, my influence in that community was, I don't want to brag, but it was a lot better. Okay. When I left after that second year, that minister thanked me for what I had done in that community. Why? Because I had demonstrated humility. Okay. Now, that is not the end of the story. I'm still working on developing humility in myself. I still lose influence because of times when I am too proud to hear another person's point of view. When I'm too proud to recognize that I might be wrong. But I go back to that story from that. That was a turning point in my life, was that experience. And I have that man to thank. I'm so glad he was stubborn, even though I hated it at the time. So how do we develop humility? I don't know how you do it in younger students, frankly. I have a 4-year-old son who has already developed intellectual pride. He already tells me when I'm wrong about things. He already knows that he knows more than I do about certain things, so he thinks. I don't know what you do. I'm working on it still. But if our students can see us modeling humility, when we make mistakes, we admit them. When we disagree with their parents about things, we actually honor the parents' position. If we model humility, students will pick it up. It's going to be a slow process, and it's not fun, and it can be really painful. But if we model it, it's a start. One of the things I try to do is I give my students an opportunity to actually study something deeply, actually know how much there is. Because in a quick Google search, you can learn a few facts. But once you start asking that question, well, why? Why does the sun shine? Because hydrogen is coming together and forming helium, and that's releasing some energy. So where's that energy coming from? Well, it's a loss of mass. How's that loss of mass happening? Well, it's inside the... And you just keep asking, why is that? And you start, eventually you get to the point where, I don't know. It's if the student gets an opportunity actually to study something until they run out of the ability to understand even what's going on, that can give them a taste of what it takes to be an expert, and hopefully helps them to recognize that experts are still needed. The other practice, so three practices in my classroom. One is I try to model humility myself. I'm not perfect and would hesitate even to say that I'm good, but I'm at least trying. I give my students an opportunity to study deeply. And third, the third practice I use is that when a student brings something that they're really sure is a dumb idea, I try to ask for the other side of the story. So a former student, sent me an article about how math education is racist because you're looking for the right answers and that's racist. And I said, okay, what's the other side of the story? What's going on here? And I actually looked it up and we had a good conversation about it. If you ask for the other side of the story, if you ask for the student to need to defend the point of view that they think is dumb, perhaps that will help them understand a little bit of what it takes to be humble. It feels like with this subject that I'm just skimming past it really fast. There's so much more. But I have a vision for schools in which wisdom grows in our classrooms because our teachers are modeling intellectual humility and students are mimicking that models. I have a vision for classrooms where we value truth over ego, where we recognize that our creation that we are created in God's image, that we are fallen, and that God is working to redeem us to himself. At the same time, I recognize that this is not about us. This entire week, I've been talking about how to develop intellectual character in our students. But Paul has words of wisdom for us here. First Corinthians 3, I, brothers, could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not with solid food, for you were not ready for it, and even now you are not yet ready, for you are still of the flesh. But while there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way? For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not being merely human? I go to school, I homeschool, are you not merely human? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered. You might even say elementary planted, secondary watered. God gives the increase. So may we faithfully plant and water in our classrooms the intellectual character traits that our students need to develop, but may we depend on God to give the increase.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.